Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York and welcome to the CFR Academic Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Thank you all for joining us. Today's call is on the record, and the audio file will be available on our website, cfr.org, if you would like to share it with your colleagues or classmates. We're delighted to have Catherine Bertini here with us to discuss food security. Ms. Bertini is Professor of Public Administration and International Affairs at Syracuse University's Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs. She also serves currently as co-chair of the Chicago Council of Global Affairs Global Agricultural Development Initiative, and chair of its Girls in Rural Economies Initiative, mouthful. From 1992 to 2002, Ms. Bertini was the executive director of the UN World Food Program. She was named the 2003 World Food Prize laureate for her work at the World Food Program towards ending famine and decreasing hunger. Catherine, thanks very much for taking the time out of your schedule to be with us today. The global food crisis has garnered increasing attention in recent years. It would be great if you could give us an overview of the current state of this issue and your recommendations on how to address this issue.
Wonderful, Irina. Thank you very much. You can hear me all right?
Yes, perfectly.
Okay, thanks. Well, hello, everyone, and I'm pleased to be with you today. Let's start with what food security is. And according to FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization, food security exists when all people at all times have physical, social, and economic access to sufficient, safe, and nutritious food that meets their dietary needs and food preferences for an active and healthy life. Household food security is the application of this concept to the family level, with individuals within households as the focus of concern. So when we're talking about food security, that's essentially what we're talking about. But if we think about this perspective from a worldwide level, we know that there are still many hundreds of millions of people who don't meet this definition of food secure. Now, depending on what kind of data you use, World Bank data, FAO data, $1 a day, less than $1 a day, $1.25 a day, so forth. You can come up with slightly different numbers, but the estimate, rough estimate, is that there are just under 1 billion people around the world who are food insecure, and that those are the people to whom much of the world's attention is directed as we talk about what can be done. And if you look at maps about where the food insecure live, you'll find that the highest numbers still live in Asia, and India, for instance, would be the country of the highest number, China second, with China fast decreasing its number, India not so fast. And then if you look at sub-Saharan Africa, you look at the highest percentages of people who are food insecure within those populations. Now, when we think about those populations, we think about what can be done or what has been done in order to increase food security and decrease poverty, because obviously poverty is directly related. And we look at the fact that many countries who had large numbers of food insecure people in the past have had significant changes, significant positive changes, in large part because of economic development. Economic development, of course, can be accomplished because of all the work done with the private sector, with the government, in order to produce more and give people better incomes. But it's also a function in some cases of aid as well. And when we think about countries like South Korea, who 40 years ago were very poor and had a lot of people food insecure, who are now major donors we see that there has been a fair amount of success. So let me circle back to those people who are food insecure. One other important factor to note is that these areas where people are food insecure are also areas where population is increasing at fairly dramatic rates. And if you recall, UN has recently put out information that suggests that by 2050, there'll be 9.5 billion people on this earth. Now, that means that we're going to have to grow a lot more food. And the estimate is that there's going to have to be about 70% more food grown in order to feed this larger population. And, in fact, then that since the larger the population growth is largely in sub-Saharan Africa and Asia, the policy view has to be how can more food be available to people in these areas. And when we think about that, of course, first and foremost, the answer is, well, developing the ability of people in sub-Saharan Africa, in various countries in Asia, to improve their own agricultural output should be first and foremost. And it's got a lot of possibilities. For instance, the countries who have become better off have almost all done so from an agricultural base, including the United States of America centuries ago, where agriculture was our major industry. That is still the case in many of these countries, so the base is available. However, what's not available in many cases is adequate infrastructure, farm-to-market roads, good ports, sometimes government laws relating to seed development or use of fertilizer, education systems that that help train agriculturalists are sometimes lacking. There are many different, and of course, basic education is often lacking. But there are many different inputs that are potentially problems. On top of that, of course, is the issue of how the climate is changing and how different countries, different regions have to adapt, in some cases, to different crops grown because of the inability to be as productive as they were, even if it wasn't very productive, because of different temperatures and different climatic conditions that are causing significant changes. Now, what needs to happen in order to dramatically increase the amount of food production in many of these countries? Several things. First, government policies that are conducive. And in Africa, for instance, there was an agreement called the Maputo Agreement, based on the meeting in Mozambique, where African countries decided that they would all work toward spending at least 10% of their own budgets on agriculture. And now some countries have reached this target. Some countries have gone beyond it. But that is one very important first step. Of course, increases in education and the commitments toward meeting the Millennium Development Goals and to getting every child in school, at least through primary school by 2015, while still aspirational, will be important too, because farmers who are educated are more productive than other farmers. It makes sense. They know how to count. They know how to read the labels. They know how to use their cell phones now as new technology in order to check on prices. There's a lot of things that can be done with even basic education to improve agricultural output. So from a national government perspective, there are issues like that, as well as I mentioned, sometimes issues required to change land ownership, for instance, rules, inheritance rules, or others in terms of agricultural inputs. What can be done from outside those governments is also very important, and that is what can be done by the international community. And if we look at what has been done in the past, up until about the mid-'80s, the donor community had been supporting agriculture, but then in deference to other issues, other things that came along, the donor community started to move in other directions and didn't provide much support for agriculture. One example in the from the U.S. perspective is that the U.S. used to train a lot of African and Asian and Latin American students in graduate programs in agriculture. We do very little of that now. China does much more of it, in fact, than the U.S. does. Anyway, it became critically important after 2008 with big price spikes for the international community to pay attention to these longer-term issues. The price of food was particularly high. The price of fuel is very high. And when President Obama took office in his inaugural address, one of the lines in his address was, "To the people of poor nations, we pledge to work alongside you to make your farms flourish." And this was an indication that his administration was going to do something about this. And as a result, they have a program called Feed the Future, which is about a $1 billion program as part of their foreign aid program, administered primarily by USAID, in an effort to try to work with countries to help support agriculture development in those countries. Now, from a U.S. perspective, this was also highlighted in the Senate by Senator Dick Lugar from Indiana and Senator Bob Casey from Pennsylvania, who put forth a bill even before the President's Initiative for Food Security, which passed out of the Foreign Relations Committee with Senator Kerry and Senator Lugar's leadership, but never got onto the Senate floor. So there's not yet a comparable initiative in the Congress. So briefly, what are some of the kinds of things that can and should be done? One other point to make, that is that President Obama and the administration took this issue up with the Italians who hosted the G8 meeting 2 years ago in Italy and in L'Aquila, Italy, and came up with what they called the L'Aquila Agreement, where all of the members of the G8 would make commitments to spending more money on agriculture development. And while all their commitments have not yet been met, the G8 meeting that's coming up this year, which is going to be at Camp David in May, is going to have on its agenda, how do we keep these commitments? How do we collectively keep these commitments? This has also become an issue with the G20, and I think the G20 meeting this year is in Mexico, where they're going to talk further about the need for increased attention. So some of the things that could be done, increasing agricultural education and extension is critical. Extension is the outreach into the community about good agricultural practices. And there are various creative ways that this could be done. Agriculture research is critically important. Most countries have their own research institutes for agriculture, but these could be greatly enhanced and supported. And there could be a lot of collaboration, especially between U.S. universities, especially the U.S. land-grant universities, that have particularly strong agriculture programs, and some of the African, Asian, Latin American universities. Another thing that could be done is increasing support for rural infrastructure, critically important roads, feeder roads. You can have a wonderful production of food, but if you can't get it out on the road to the market, you are nowhere. And from a U.S. perspective, the Millennium Challenge Corporation, MCC, is working in some countries in order to build infrastructure, in part for agriculture. But this also needs attention from the World Bank and others. Another thing can be done is to improve the international institutions that deliver agriculture development assistance, from the bilateral donors like USAID, Peace Corps, DFID, the British Aid Agency, to the international organization. And then the U.S. can change some of its own policies in order to be more supportive. Top on the list are some of our trade distorting policies, our agriculture subsidies, as well as some of our barriers to buying other countries' food. Some of our food aid policies need to be revisited. Recently, there have been some positive moves on the biofuel policies, in that the U.S. government didn't extend their own tax credits for biofuels and did not extend the import fees they were charging. But there are still programs related to biofuels that could be changed to be more supportive. So those are a few of the issues here. One final one that I want to end with before we have questions and discussion is the role of women. Now, when you look in the developing world at who are the farmers, and any of you who have traveled internationally and driven in the countryside and seen who is working in the field will be able to attest to the fact that the majority of them are women. And in fact, women are the largest majority of farmers in the world and produce the largest number, the largest amount of food in the world. Much of this is done for low or no pay on family-owned farms. Not all of it. Some of it is with pay. But nonetheless, women are absolutely critical to agriculture production. One of the things that all of the policies, whether they're national policies in countries or whether they're donor policies or international organizations, is that the policymakers need to think through who actually does the work. What are the traditional roles of women, of men, and of all different aspects? It could be in one crop where women do certain things like weeding and men do the planting or women do the harvesting. It varies dramatically. And we have to pay attention to the gender differentiations of who does what, because if we don't, then we just make kind of general decisions and policies around helping farmers and not paying attention to what the special needs of those farmers are. Just to give you one quick example, one time years ago I visited a community in Angola that had recently been, the land had recently been demined after the war, and an organization I was with had sent farm implements to the community, and they sent hoes, which looked like the kind of hoes I have in my shed, which would be a long wooden pole with a spade on the end, this kind of rectangular shape attached at about a 90-degree angle to the pole, and you kind of bend over and almost rake when you use this pole, this hoe, in order to dig in your garden or in your plot of land. Well, the women in this community in Angola all complained to me that they couldn't work because they didn't have any hoes. And I said, what's wrong with those hoes? They said, oh, no, those are male hoes. And it's the first time I knew there was a gender differentiation, at least in this community in Angola, in hoes. And I said, well, what's a female hoe? So they brought out a shorter poled implement with kind of a pointy, shovely kind of metal spade that met at maybe like a 50, 55-degree angle with the pole. And in order to use this hoe, you had to squat down, and it dug further into the ground, but you had to actually be squatting in order to use it as opposed to just bending over, standing up. And why did women prefer those hoes? Because most of the women were working all day in the fields with babies on their backs, and it was less backbreaking, actually, to squat with that baby on her back than to bend over with a baby on her back. So this is what she preferred. But we didn't know that. Nobody knew that. So nobody sent the right implements. And by the way, the women in this community, in this part of the world, were the only ones that were going to be working in the field. So just one tiny example, but when I talk about women, I'm talking a much broader example, that we have to pay attention to the gender differentiations of who does what if we want to be most supportive of people in communities where there could be potentially a much greater production of food that could help to improve the food security of literally hundreds of millions of people. Thank you.
Catherine, thank you very much for that analysis and overview. Really terrific. Now let's go, Kelly, to the students' questions around the country.
Thank you. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, press star 2. Again, to ask a question, press star 1. Our first question comes from Ohio State University. Ohio State, your line is now open.
Carrie, maybe we should go to the next question.
Okay, we'll take our next question from Virginia Tech.
Hi, I would like to thank you for the presentation. And my first question I have has to do with the notion of food security versus another often contrasted term, food sovereignty, which you can, Vandana Shiva talks about in the form of food democracy. But I was just wondering first how, if you think that the two are contrast, as some people think, and also in a second question, how do you balance the need and influence of big agribusinesses and versus the needs of individual farmers? And that's all I have right now. Thank you.
Should I respond to each question, or do we?
Yes, let's take each question.
Oh, okay. I'll go to the second one first. As far as agribusiness is concerned, to be successful, any farming community really needs to have a range of size of farmers and unless it's a country with a very sophisticated farming system, the vast majority of farmers are going to be smallholder farmers, essentially people with small plots of land, and on which they work. So, I think of the policy recommendations the countries are getting into are recommendations that are focused on, first and foremost, supporting those smallholder farmers. Now, what do they need? I mean, they need real basics. They may need laws that allow them to own their land. They need inputs. They may need fertilizer. They sometimes need basic tools. They need credit. So some of the real basics, and there's a lot of work going on helping to support this population. But in order ultimately for that population to work and some of the population to be really successful, become middle-income farmers, there's got to be a range. You know, that might be the low range, and then there's the next level, and then there's the highest level. So obviously agribusiness is important at every level. I mean, there are some great models in Africa run by AGRA, the Alliance for Green Revolution in Africa, where agribusiness in the form of a woman or a man who runs a tiny little agro dealer shop becomes the extension worker as well as the liaison with the bank for the loans and so forth, and it's really become a very successful model. So if you scale that up, I mean, certainly there's going to be ways and opportunities for farmers to be able to ultimately sell to much bigger agribusiness companies, and that's, I think, part of a overall successful system. Now, food sovereignty is more about kind of like the right, as I understand it, the right of people to define their own systems, as opposed to having international market forces say what they are. I mean, I think it's a question of the sophistication of the system, because right now we're talking about people that are so poor in terms of the people that are food insecure that there aren't international market forces that are going to get in their way one way or another. They need to be able to till their land. They need inputs to till their land. They need laws that allow them to be able to do that. And they're so far away from international pricing or selling internationally that those aren't even issues. And once they are able to sell internationally, then we get into issues like trade barriers that are put up by the U.S. or the Europeans or the Japanese, or then we get into issues of subsidies by those same bigger countries. But I think there's a huge, huge, huge space before any of those become issues. And first and foremost, we want to help people have enough food to eat every day, and that can be done locally.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the American University.
Hello. Thank you for your very interesting talk. My name is Garrett Crady. I'm at the American University. So I wanted to pick up from the last question that was asked, that was very compelling, and think through this idea of food security as the primary goal of some of this work and this policy. Wouldn't there need to be some support for local and semi-subsistence even, and I mean that kind of through a village or community or household, in addition to having the option to grow for export?
Oh, yes, absolutely. If I'm suggesting that you only grow for export, that's absolutely not what my intent at all. Growing for export is what's done after you're really pretty successful. And it's not the first thing that's done for food security. I mean, if we were going to think of a progression, the first thing for the billion people who are food insecure is to have enough food available right there in their community and have enough, and that they've either grown or they have enough income to be able to buy. And so that's the basic food security that we're talking about achieving. And once that is achieved, that means that people are better off, whether they're better off because they are more productive in their crops, or they're better off because they've started a small business whatever reason, they're better off, then they can afford to do other things. And one of those other things is to start thinking about trading. And it's kind of the natural progression of a growing agriculture market of their own. But that's, as I said, that's really far, in my view, far away from basic food security. It's connected over the long term, because the more income a country has, the more options they have about what they want to be able to buy. I mean, right now, we in the U.S., we could buy everything we want locally. I mean, assuming, obviously, an individual can afford it. We could buy everything we want locally, or we could buy all sorts of imported products. That's an ideal for any country based on their own agriculture production.
Mm-hmm. Great. That's very helpful. I have another question, but I don't want to take time from other people who might have questions as well, so maybe I can hold off and ask a more climate change-oriented question in a moment.
That would be great. We'll circle back to you.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the Colin Powell Center for Leadership and Service.
Hi, my name is Colleen. I have a question somewhat related to the initial question of agribusiness. We already sort of answered the agribusiness role, and I'm curious, how do their interests for the agribusiness and multinational corporations affect our thinking of regulatory policies?
Can you say that over again, please?
Sure. My question is, how do the interests of agribusiness and multinational corporations affect our thinking of regulatory policy?
Oh, okay.
On the international level.
Okay. Well, a couple of different ways. Of course, any country, take the U.S., for example, the U.S. Trade Representative's Office is involved, but also regulation of its own, regulation of, for instance, the Food and Drug Administration would regulate any issues as it relate to what it is we eat. But the international regulatory body is something called Codex Alimentarius, which is an intergovernmental body jointly between the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, and the World Health Organization, WHO. And they're the ones that essentially extend what the FDA does on the national level to international level about saying what works. In terms of regulations about what kind of food is healthy and appropriate. So do agribusiness firms or others try to influence those kind of entities? I'm sure they do. But what one thing I think that FDA and also this Codex Alimentarius group is proud of is that it's very much evidence-based, and its work is absolutely done on decisions done on the basis of the right kind of evidence. I hope I'm answering your question, and I'm a little bit intimidated by the fact that you come from the Colin Powell Center for Leadership and Service, because I think he's one of the most wonderful leaders in service in this country and the world that we've had in our generation. So thank you.
Thank you.
Next question.
Our next question comes from Auburn University.
Hi. Can you talk about the relationship between the global trade regime, thinking about the WTO and bilateral agreements, and the ag sector in the global south? And specifically, do you see any opportunities for changes at that level that would favor the growth of the ag industries in less developed countries? It seems like wealthy countries don't want to budge on their restrictions or protections.
Yes, I think you're correct in your last statement that there was over time in the last, I'm not sure how many years, I'm going to say 15 years, maybe 20, maybe longer, until the last 10 years or so, some progress on trade matters, particularly as they relate to agriculture, and they called the Doha round. The last meeting that kind of fell apart was in Hong Kong. I think it was about, somebody else online may be able to know this, but I think it was about 6 years ago, maybe. Fell apart largely on agriculture-related issues. And there's absolutely been no movement since. The only movement, if you look at it from a U.S. perspective, has been that we've gotten some trade agreements now with several other countries bilaterally, but not the global agreement. I've maybe very frank, this year is a big year for elections in the U.S., in France, in Russia, and a whole bunch of countries, if I do recall. So I don't think anything will happen in this calendar year, but I would strongly recommend to people that are interested in this that as soon as there is either a reelected president or a new president, and as soon as there's a new Congress in this country, that you tell them of your interest in having some real movement on agriculture issues. Let me also say that from the U.S. perspective, 2012 is the year that the U.S. is supposed to reauthorize the Farm Bill. Now, the Farm Bill is the law that authorizes many programs, including SNAP, which is the old food stamp program, and others. But it also authorizes all of the U.S. farm policy programs. So the subsidy programs, all of those come under this thing called the Farm Bill. And it's got a five-year term, which so it's up in 2012. There is a little bit of discussion in the Senate about this, almost no discussion in the House. And if there is nothing done, this is my prediction, before the summer starts, there's certainly not going to be anything done in the fall. Again, my prediction. So then they may just extend whatever exists into 2013. Maybe not. Maybe something will be done now. But in any event, the reason why I raise this is because this is where some of these trade-distorting policies exist. And the benefit that exists now in this country for people who want to change some of those is that the prices have been so high for so long, a lot of these subsidies make no sense anymore. You add to that the fact that the Congress is looking for different ways to cut the budget. Then it becomes, well, wait a minute, why doesn't this now make sense? Now, if you add a couple other things to this, and I apologize for the length of this question, but I do want to get out these points, or length of this answer. There are a couple of other points, too. If you look at the kinds of crops that the U.S. subsidizes, they bear no relation to what we say on the other side of our mouth when we tell people what's good to eat. You look at the dietary guidelines for Americans and what's good to eat, and then we end up subsidizing almost against that. So we've got the issue of the budget, that could be cut. We've got the issue of the farm prices being so high that subsidies aren't necessary. We've got the issue of the competition between what we grow and what we're supposed to eat. And all of that combines to this being a really critical time for potentially for some change. And what I propose and what the Chicago Council for Global Affairs, with whom I'm affiliated, proposes and has proposed to Congress, is that they consider having a program that supports farmers from catastrophic loss, kind of an insurance program for farmers, for all farmers, not just the farmers that currently get the subsidies, and that we do that and instead eliminate all the subsidies. And then, therefore, that means vegetable growers could get this insurance if they have a bad year. And after all, we should be encouraging more vegetables to be grown in the United States, for an example. Anyway, I'll stop there.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Florida A&M University College of Law.
Hello, my name is Monique, and my question is regarding the food security measures that are already in place in Ghana and Brazil that have already proven to be somewhat successful. I just wanted to know how are nonprofits and other policy analysts pushing those models in other struggling countries? Thank you.
That's a good question. Ghana and Brazil have had a lot of success. Other countries have had as well. And one of the recognitions you might note about Ghana and Brazil is that last year the World Food Prize was given to the past presidents of Ghana and Brazil, in part to recognize the work that they have done in leading their countries. And it's also interesting to note, if you look at a map of the globe, and you can see where centuries and centuries ago, South America was and Africa were combined. You know, if you look at kind of the eastern tip of Brazil, which kind of could flow into the kind of the under the elbow of Africa, when that all used to be one landmass. If you look at the areas of Brazil that are some of its primary agriculture area now in the last several decades that they've concentrated on this, it's the same soil basis over through into the what would be adjacent part of Africa. So there's a lot of view that there's some of the great bases that could be used in Africa, but you asked more about policies and not about the land. The policies in both places are combinations of agriculture policies as well as kind of social safety net policies. The Zero Hunger Program, for instance, that past President Lula put in place in Brazil, which included school feeding programs. There's school feeding programs in both countries, by the way. As well as programs to help increase agriculture production. And yes, I think a lot of countries are looking at those countries, and Brazil in particular has been pretty proactive about sharing its experience with other countries. And also just one small footnote, the new head of the Food and Agriculture Organization is Brazilian and one who was involved with Lula. So one hopes that he's had enough of his own domestic experience that could help internationally.
Okay. Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Columbia University.
Hi, Catherine. Thank you so much for your wonderful presentation. I'm very struck about your last comment, which is about empowering women. And, in fact, I started an organization to develop future women leaders in developing countries. And my question is something that's very close tied to food security, and that is land rights. So it seems like you're talking about tools and things that needs to be adapted to women, but what about really creating policies and land rights that is going to give rights for women to own land? And I know that the United Nations reports 1% of world land is owned by women. So I'm looking more about issues and policies that will move that forward.
You're absolutely right. Well, first of all, congratulations on developing a program to support future leaders. You know, women, there's also so much potential among women, but they, in many cases, they just need an extra helping hand or an opportunity to speak out or to have some confidence. And you are right, land rights is one of the issues that is important. From when I talked earlier about what governments need to do, it's critical that the whole land ownership issue is important, and it has to do with inheritance rights, it has to do with who can own land, it has to do with who can take out loans, who can own bank accounts. There's a whole range of issues that are critical in that sense. Without them, you know, in many countries, women will not be able to progress. The Rural Development Institute, I don't know if it has a new name or not, based in Seattle, and maybe some. Do I have that name right? There was this great group based in Seattle that did really, really good work on issues of land rights.
Well, if I may, is there anything that's being done that, you know, as we're developing food security policies and et cetera, that would coincide with land rights?
I'm sorry, say that again, that what?
Well, is there any policy that they're developing together as we're developing food security that would also promote land rights for women?
Yes, it's one of the issues. It's one of the issues that is part of any of our interactions with governments to review their laws relating to the ease of being able to be a farmer, essentially, and that means for women and men, and it goes from land ownership and basic rights of to operate under the law to restrictions on inputs and then also issues of infrastructure. So there's a whole range of things that absolutely does include land rights. No, I just Googled this while we were talking. The Rural Development Institute changed its name to Landesa, L-A-N-D-E-S-A. When I was working with the Gates Foundation, these folks provided us with some really good data on land rights issues.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Ohio State University.
Hello. Sorry about our earlier technical difficulties. Our question has to do with food security and from the aid perspective, I guess the politics of aid. For instance, fortified foods such as the Plum Peanut product, which I know is distributed a lot for starvations, like they're going to distribute in Niger. There's a lot of barriers to trade with those type of products. I know there's a big copyright problem, a patent on the Plum Peanut product. So how are international institutions and structures compensating for those barriers to trade to make sure that we have food security for those in famine situations?
Trade barriers, quite problematic. I know, I just referenced the Gates Foundation, but I know they've been working on this as it relates to some of the bigger U.S. corporations that are working on seed development, for instance. So that we could get beyond some of these issues. One of the programs that where we had some success with WFP and could be successful with support from others is for development of domestic fortified food systems to create things like Plumpy Nut, if not Plumpy Nut. There was a guy at the World Food Program some years ago that I've pulled in since as a consultant in different places who was instrumental in India and Bangladesh, even in North Korea, in setting up indigenous operations to make baby food in this case that was fortified and with locally grown foods, and actually ended up starting little small industries, well, not necessarily North Korea, but in the other places that could carry on once the idea got put in place. So I think that's a highly beneficial approach.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Virginia Tech.
Hi. Earlier, you mentioned a lot about the getting fertilizers to farmers and to small farmers, but I'm wondering what you think about the possibility of organic principles being used on a larger scale, because high input seeds or farming can have a negative effect on the land, especially if pesticides or herbicides are used. And I'm just wondering what you think, where a balance is there.
Well, a lot of it's going to depend on the soil. A lot of it's going to depend on the climate. Most of these areas, again, with talking about food insecure smallholder farmers, have never had any treatment at all. It's often very, very difficult to grow anything from essentially from scratch. I don't know if that's a good agricultural term, but fertilizer is highly preferable in most of these economies. I think my own view is that being totally organic and having no fertilizer use whatsoever is kind of in many cases, and some may disagree with me, but in many cases, kind of a second generation luxury that some of these farmers can't afford. I mean, they're organic now, and they're not self-sufficient, and they can't grow. They're organic just because they don't have anything else, and they're not self-sufficient. So what can make them in a reasonably fast amount of time be able to have a bigger production on their very small plot of land? So it's going to be much more important over the short term. Now, in some of the countries where there's a sophisticated and well-off urban population, you'll find large-scale organic farmers. But these are guys also with irrigation. Guys, I'm saying, too, because they're big farmers, more likely than it's going to be more male, with large irrigation systems and with reasonable transport systems and reasonable distribution setup.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Texas A&M University.
Thank you, ma'am, for speaking with us today. My question relates to land-grant universities and how they can better contribute to international agricultural development.
Oh, what a good question. And I know that this people on this call are a mix of land-grant universities and not, and so excuse me for the land-grants, but let me, to the others, say that, and I think it was 1868, there was a law passed that created a land grant university in every state, and those universities concentrate. They have many other areas of expertise, but they concentrate on agriculture. And in addition to that, of course, there's the historically black colleges as well, and many of whom also concentrate on agriculture. These universities have done some work, and sometimes some very important work, with universities or agriculture ministries in other countries. But this needs financial support, and quite often that financial support does not exist. And as I mentioned before, in the past 20 years at least, maybe 30, there has been very little support from the U.S. government for this kind of work. And so I hesitate to tell the government about policies that cost them money, but nonetheless, one of the best, most impactful ways that they could spend some money is to do more to connect American agriculture universities, especially land grants and historically black colleges, with
partners in the field. Now, one thing we shouldn't do is say, go trotting over to Zambia and say, hi, I'm Texas A&M, I'm here to help you. But what one of the things we've been promoting at the Chicago Council is that AID should give a menu to countries in which they're working and say, okay, here are the various expertise in potato growing, in goat raising, in cassava growing, in maize growing, and so forth, or different scientific approaches and research and everything, and have kind of like their own menu about the great things that Texas A&M does and Virginia State and, I mean, Virginia Tech and Ohio State and Florida A&M and Auburn, so forth. Cornell, I have to say Cornell. I'm sitting at Syracuse. And so if we have this kind of a list, almost like a menu, then we could say, okay, Zambia, you know, in order to meet your own food security goals, we know you'd like to do X and Y, and so therefore we'd like to connect you, and the U.S. government will give some money to support it to, you know, University X that's really good at that, and then you take it from there. I think we should do much, much more of that.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Brigham Young University.
Hi. You've mentioned that in order to ensure food security for our world's growing population, the world will have to produce a lot more food. And I've read from other sources that argue that we already produce enough and that the problem is really more about equal food distribution than it is about production. What are your thoughts about the argument?
Yeah, we've said that for years. There's enough food produced in the world for every man, woman, and child if only they had access to food. That's what we've said for years and years. So if you take all the food produced in the world and divide it by the number of people in the world, yep, that's true. But I personally have gone beyond. So I used to say that and say, you know, we just need to do little things here and there. But it's just not realistic that we can just divide that food and then pass it out and everybody can have it. It's not available in sub-Saharan Africa in anywhere near extent that it's available in Slovakia. So that's, we really have to be more attentive to having it be available where the population is. And because the population is growing, we will have to produce 70% more food in order to reach this new population. So how much of that food can be produced in the U.S. or Europe or Japan or the traditional old-time traders is one issue, but that almost doesn't matter if the countries are so poor that they can't buy it, which gets back to needing to grow food where people are. And so, yes, you're absolutely right. That's the mantra. That's what we've said for years. But when you really break it down, the distribution and the math don't match.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Stony Brook University.
Hi. I'm really curious to know, especially about Don Huber's studies out of Purdue, that these GMO crops and seeds are doing really serious damage. The 250,000 suicides in India from BT cotton, drought, and the crop failure. Also with Gates putting billions of dollars into these purchases of land in Africa and other countries, what's going on with the massive increases of pesticides and fertilizers? We've got the drought resistant, we've got the resistant insects and weeds now that are forcing us to use the 2,4-D on the crops because the Roundup Ready crops are not producing, they're failing. What are we doing about these? Because especially with fuel prices escalating and peak oil, these are very heavily fuel-dependent technologies. what are we doing about the ecological issues on these, and how are we dealing with these on a policy basis?
Okay, well, a couple of things. First of all, a lot of your questions are in detail that I won't go into, but I'm Googling Don Huber while you're talking about him, a retired professor of plant pathology at Purdue University. Recently, Purdue University faculty members have responded to his claims using peer-reviewed science, refuting his statements. So I don't know him, but he's controversial, obviously. But to the point of the fuel dependency and the ecological issues, there were some issues back in India when in the initial Green Revolution, which was so dramatic in terms of increasing the food availability in India and decreasing hunger in India, even though there's still a long way to go. But now a lot of the lessons learned about fertilizer use and ecology issues and so forth have been learned, I think, very well in terms of the, for instance, the agriculture, the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, which is kind of the African approach to dealing with increased food production. So the ecological issues, the issues of water, the issues of availability of water long term, of how any sort of chemicals could be harmful beyond the area in which they're to be used. A lot of these issues are issues where the new farmers and the new policies are well aware and are trying to be careful of. The issue of fuel dependency, of course, some of the same ingredients are important in fertilizer, but otherwise, fuel is, again, for a smallholder farmer, one of the last things that they think about because their fuel is their own labor. So they're very, you know, it's not even second generation, fifth generation away. I don't mean in terms of people, but in terms of just agriculture steps before they get the luxury of thinking about fuel issues related to their agriculture practices.
I'm sorry to all those that have queued up. We have a lot of questions, and we are at the end of our time. I think we'll just take one more, and then we'll have to close. So my apologies to all those that we didn't get to.
Our final question comes from Roosevelt University.
Hi, my name is Alex Karmgard at Roosevelt University, and I found a couple interesting studies on world poverty. One was published by the British Medical Journal. It's called the Barker Hypothesis, and it states that if every woman had access to iodine capsules, there would be a 7.5% increase in total educational attainment of children in Central and Southern Africa. Also, according to a foundation called WISE, they found that in Indonesia, men who received iron supplements had a high increase in their ability to work, which affected their productivity. Has there been any attention paid to the benefits of this type of nutrition by the international community?
Yeah, very good question. The lead government that's been paying attention to this is Canada, and their aid, their equivalent of USAID, is called CEDA. I think it's Canadian International Development Agency. They have for many years been promoting a micronutrient distribution and development and locally grown, locally manufactured micronutrients as a really important issue in overall development and in personal productivity. So that's the place of any government anywhere where I would look for some really good work on this area. There's also a program called GAIN, G-A-I-N, international program, which is in Geneva, which would, I think, be able to give you more information about this, too. But both of those are very good examples of a big deficiency that if met, could make a huge difference in the lives of people. And, of course, let me close my comment on that, on your point, particularly about the iodine capsules for women. I mean, the productive capacity for women is already huge, but they also are greatly harmed by their loss of blood and by their anemia and other related issues. And and they're also critically important, as the Grameen Bank and others will tell you, in the ultimate movement away from poverty of their families, and certainly for food security improvements. So ability to use programs like this to help support women is to be dramatic.
Well, Catherine, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today. This was a terrific hour of discussion and analysis, and we are leaving the group wanting more, as evidenced by all the questions in queue. And again, thanks to all of you for your comments and questions, and I apologize to those that we couldn't. Our next call will be on Thursday, April 12th at 12 p.m. Eastern Time. Gregory Gause, professor and chair of the University of Vermont Political Science Department, will discuss his new Council Special Report on Saudi Arabia in the New Middle East. And you can go to our website, CFR.org, for daily updates on pressing foreign policy issues and the like, as well as access to Foreign Affairs, our journal on international relations. So thank you all again in today's call, and thank you, Catherine Bertini, for your discussion.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.